Catholic Connection is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo.
Welcome to Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo, keeping you connected to your faith and your world. Teresa tackles the issues of faith and culture, the pro-life message, and media awareness. And now, here's Teresa Tomeo.
It is November 25th, 2020. Wishing you a blessed Wednesday, also a blessed Thanksgiving holiday. Despite all of the many issues we're facing in our country, in our world, in our church, thanks be to God, we still have so much to be thankful for. And one of the things I'm thankful for, of course, is Jesus. One of the my faith, the fact that I can work at a network like this, operated by EWTN and Ave Maria Radio, that allows us to speak the truth in love, and that has a certain relationship with coworkers. So we're not just coworkers, but we truly are family, and you are part of that family. That's why in this edition of Catholic Connection, this live program before we take off for a few days for the holiday, we're going to break with normal programming and bring Al Cresta, CEO of Ave Maria Communications, author, international speaker, and of course host of Cresta in the Afternoon, to join us with a statement about the loss of one of our family members, something we were dreading. We knew it was coming, but even though you're trying to prepare for it mentally, when you lose someone you love so much and you know so much and you've worked so closely with over the years, it's still heartbreaking. So Al is going to spend about the first 10 minutes with me this morning just chatting about Nick Tom, who went to be with the Lord yesterday. And then we'll also be speaking with Greg and Julie Alexander and Joan Lewis, as we normally do on a Wednesday. Al Cresta joins me this morning. Al, we knew this was coming. But, boy, it just doesn't take the sting away when it happens. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Teresa. Thanks. Nick was with us just about from the beginning when we started Ave Maria Radio. Mm-hmm. He joined us around 2001, I think it was, when he came on board really as a reporter for a newspaper that we were publishing at the time called Credo. Nick had been a graduate of the Franciscan University of Steubenville. He had was working for the local newspaper down there, really checking the police blotter and just doing, you know, kind of the basic grunt work that you have to do to put out a daily paper. And I remember interviewing him. Our managing editor at the time, Jay McNally, became aware of him and then called me in to take a look at him before we hired him. And there are a few things about Nick that I really liked right away, and one of them was actually his relationship with his wife, Jen. There was, just from our conversation, it was clear that they both had a sense of mission together, that they were really, really bound together, not only as husband and wife, but also as co-workers in the faith. It was quite beautiful. She was teaching at a local school called Everest Academy.
Mm-hmm.
And so we hired Nick, and then when we shut the newspaper down, he moved over to radio and became the producer of Cresta in the Afternoon. And he was young. He was young, and he learned quickly. Nick had a drivenness about him, or look, that's not quite right. He had drive.
Right.
Rephrase that. He had drive. He was good to work. He took direction well, but he was also is what you want in a producer. He could also speak his mind, which is not always the case. So he was able to tell me what he thought about different things we were doing, and we grew very close over the years. I've never had a producer I worked with for such a long period of time.
Right.
But when we grew especially close after I lost my leg.
You know. Right.
I was in the hospital, and our general manager, Mike Jones, visited, and Nick and I talked actually quite a bit during that time, because you and he really carried the program. I didn't return for about 6 months.
Right, I remember
and
that.
So the program rested on the two of you. And then eventually, when I came back, we were, you know, it was during the Gulf War, you know, the second Gulf War. And so we had a lot to jump to right away. But that was back in, what, 2003?
Yeah, because I started in 2002. It's 18 years this year for me at Ave Maria.
Yeah,
yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. 18 years. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. So, and, so yeah, Nick, I remember that. Mm-hmm.
So, Nick, you know, we worked together for a few years, and then, in fact, we did a book together, too, called Moments of Grace.
Yep, mm-hmm.
And then he, then one morning on the way to Mass, he was unable to lift his foot off the accelerator, as I remember it. And Jen finally got control of the car. They went right. The experience passed, but Jen insisted they go to the hospital. And they discovered he had a brain tumor.
Yeah.
So it was something they were going to have to deal with up until yesterday, when he passed away at 9:30 in the morning, well, roughly 9:30 in the morning. His wife, Jen, texted me a few minutes after he went to be with the Lord. And, you know, over the last few weeks, and you'd been out to visit him too.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Over the last few weeks, we've been watching him in his decline. And he entered into hospice care maybe a month ago. Jen was caring for him, his wife. They had a nurse who would come in. I don't know how often, but his three children, Sarah, David, and Andrew, were all really engaged in caring for him during his decline. So he was a family to the very end. And I'd never seen that before, just from my own experience. I'd never seen a family gathered around the dying father. It was amazing. Each in his own way had something to share. There were people in to pray regularly. Nick, everybody should know that Nick sought, you know, supernatural healing throughout this whole experience.
Right.
It's like we prayed in Jerusalem for him. And you know, as far as we can know, as far as we can know humanly, but I think we know with some assurance, based on the teaching of the church, he died as he lived, trying to be in a state of grace.
Right.
He was diligent about the faith. He was learning. He received the sacrament of anointing recently. Parish priest, Father Ed Freedy, had been a stalwart in ministering to the whole family. And a few weeks ago, Father Dave Pavanka, who's now president of the Franciscan University of Steubenville, actually came up. Nick and Jen knew him when they were, you know, students at Franciscan way back when. So when we got, excuse me, I had slept quite a bit. I'd just gotten up.
No, it was quite a day yesterday, so
yeah.
No problem. I appreciate you joining us. I wanted to get back to a couple of points that you made that I think impressed people so much, and you were there 2 years ago when they gave a keynote at the Beautiful World Marriage Day dinner where you and Sally also gave your testimony a few years prior to Nick and Jen. But I think what's so important about what you said about their marriage, sometimes when people pass away, people, you know, we all, you know, say nice things because you don't want to speak ill of the dead. But in their case,
right,
what they have witnessed for us in terms of marriage, and Julie and Greg Alexander are going to be joining us at the bottom of the hour. This is what we're talking about when we're talking about this covenant relationship, when we're talking about in sickness and in health. And this is what the world does not get. When you are committed to someone, to a loved one, and you're with them, toward the end, you know, for the good times and the bad times, what can happen in terms, as painful as it is, there is a healing, there is closure, and the way the children wrapped around him and were there and helping with the care, that is a witness to children about the beauty of life in all of its stages. And that's what so many people run away from, and what's so beautiful about our faith that they gave us up until the end of Nick's earthly life.
Yeah, very true. I mean, I don't know when they adopted St. Faustina's motto, but Jesus, I trust,
in you. Right.
Yeah. I don't know if that had been their motto, you know, through their marriage together, but it certainly was over the last, 14 years, I'd say. And that was really present. That was undoubtedly true. People over the years would ask, you know, how's Nick doing? And, up until maybe 2 years ago, you know, I would just give kind of the medical information, which he shared with me. And then about 2 years ago, largely after he stopped working on the air at the station, then I began to focus in on actually how he was doing, not just how his body was doing, but how he was doing. And I can say that he showed a serenity over the last 2 years, 2.5 years, that was new to him, in my experience of him anyways. I think by natural temperament, he wasn't given to being a serene person. Like I said, he was a person with a lot of drive, and sometimes he could be driven. But this serenity that eventually came to rest on him really beautifully suited him. It wasn't something that I saw as a natural part of his temperament. It seemed to be some work of grace that came upon him as he drew closer to the close of his life. And he had real assurances over the last few weeks. And I don't know all the details, but I do think that he had a number of experiences, judging from some of the details that Jenna shared, that he saw the Lord. And, I'm sure she'll be sharing those in more detail in due course. I'm reluctant to try to go into them because I wasn't there. You would think that a young man of his stature, his drivenness, his talent, his ambition, he had a godly ambition, you would think that he would complain. And I have to say, this is one of the strangest things.
Yeah.
I don't recall him ever complaining.
I don't about either. Yeah.
This terrible, I mean, this was a terrible hand he was dealt, you know, when he was going through his most productive years. Mm-hmm. And as a father, Nick could complain about other things, so I knew he was capable of that. He wasn't somebody who just passively accepted the status quo. In fact, one of the reasons I hired him was because he had that drive to change things. But when I would ask him how he was dealing with this, you know, quote, bad luck, right? We didn't believe in luck, but how do you deal with these being dealt such a bad hand? He surprisingly just sort of accepted it as part of the, you know, this is what was part of my genetic makeup. This God's ways are inscrutable. He is a good God. He is perfect in all his ways. So I think Nick, at least in my life, Nick exhibited more than anybody I've known a way of walking with the Lord right into eternity. In the last few years of his life, as he was lost his ability to speak and was hobbled in so many other ways, he really did exhibit, I think, what St. Ambrose said when he said, to the good man, to die is to gain. And as I have to say, as Nick edged closer and closer to eternity, he seemed to embody that confidence. And while I wasn't with him 24 hours a day, like Jen was, she was very faithful in communicating with us, those who were close, of what was going on and could be quite candid about it too. But I think we saw Nick ministered to me as much in this last year of his life as he worked with me for 14 years as my producer. And I have to say that he definitely changed my attitude about how to approach end-of-life issues.
Mm-hmm. And suffering, I think, in general, for all of us,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Al, thanks so much. I know that we all contributed to a beautiful documentary that the Sisters of Mary, Mother of the Eucharist, because Jen works with them at the Spiritus Sanctus Academies, they're putting together a video tribute. When might we see parts of that? Any word on that yet?
No, I haven't heard a thing about it, and I don't know where they are with the production, so I wish I could say more.
Are you going to be addressing this afternoon on Crest in the Afternoon?
Yeah, I think, you know, we were thinking, we didn't do it yesterday because it was too close,
right.
And I needed time to think about it, too, mm-hmm. rather than, you know, just start jumping on the air and blathering. But, yeah, we'll be bringing it up today for certain.
All right. Well, thanks for getting up early and joining us. I know it was a rough day for everyone, especially you, hearing the news that he passed away. But we're grateful for the opportunity to speak about him and to share what a witness he was and what a witness both he and his wife are to marriage and what it means to have that covenant relationship. And we're going to be talking more about that with Julian Greg Alexander. Al Cresta joining me this morning to talk about the passing of Nick Thom, who's executive producer, very talented producer, writer, speaker, and author. Gone into greater glory, passing away at the young age of 41 following complications of a brain tumor. We'll be right back.
People ask how they can care for older family members who can't fully care for themselves. One answer is Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care. Visiting Angels assists adults nationwide with 600 locations to continue living at home and not have to move into a nursing home. Their caregivers provide assistance in hygiene, meals, and light housework. Services are provided up to 24 hours per day, and you can select your caregiver before service begins. More information, including franchise opportunities, is on the web at visitingangels.com.
Location, location, location. These are the three most important factors in real estate. The same might be said for colleges. Trudging through snow to get to an 8 a.m. statistics class is a much different experience than breezing by a palm tree to the raucous applause of a laughing gull. With the average temperature of 84 degrees and wetland nature as your backdrop, it's no wonder students tend to stay once they visit our campus. Ave Maria University, your future location, location, location. Visit avemaria.edu.
This program is brought to you in part by Charity Mobile, a proud partner of Ave Maria Radio for over 15 years. Charity Mobile is the pro-life cell phone company and has sent nearly $2 million to thousands of pro-life charities. 4G LTE coverage is available nationwide, and 5% of your monthly plan price goes to your favorite pro-life charity. A video introduction is available at CharityMobile.com. Charity Mobile. Everyday living. Effortless giving. CharityMobile.com.
This Ave Maria program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit CMF Curo. Your search for affordable health care stops here. Since 2014, CMF Curo has provided Catholics with affordable health care sharing that goes beyond insurance. With programs that cost less than many COBRA and ACA-sponsored plans, CMF Curo is a Catholic health sharing experience that enables you to live fully alive while saving money. Call 1-833-GET-CURO to find affordable Catholic health care now. That's 1-833-GET-CURO.
I might have gone to church, you know, at Christmas time. Gradually quit going. It's not as scary as I thought it was. It's a much more warm and open place, and God really is about love. It's not about the rules and the things that I remember as a young child. It really is about the love that God has for each one of us that's so deep and wonderful.
If you've been away from the Catholic Church for any reason, visit CatholicsComeHome.org.
Look at everything through the lens of Scripture and the teachings of the Catholic Church, as Al Cresta always says. It's Catholic Connection, a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN. EWTN.com and AveMariaRadio.net. Pleasure to have Mary Eberstadt back on with us. Her latest release in terms of a book, Primal Screams, How the Sexual Revolution Created Identity Politics. Mary, your article that really has gone viral, that was on First Things, there's so many great points. And when you look at what's happening on the streets of the country, and you mentioned the one scene that keeps standing out in my mind. You see that young woman, a white woman, screaming in the face of an African-American officer, just screaming and calling him names and screaming that he's part of the problem, and the rage that is being expressed. It's like, where is this coming from? And you're attempting to address this in this article. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Teresa.
So your thoughts, so what is behind all of this, or at least a big part of it, do you think?
Well, so I wrote this article called The Fury of the Fatherless, which suggests the answer to the question. In other words, since May, there have been over 10,000 incidents of unrest in the streets of the United States. And of those incidents, some 500 turned violent. And this wasn't just limited to a city, say, Portland, Seattle. No, these were taking place all over the country. Now, we all know the standard explanation for this, which is Black Lives Matter's explanation, which is this is all about racism. And in the essay, I get into that explanation and dismiss it because I think something else is going on. The United States is not a racist country. There are racist incidents, and they are deplorable. But it's not systemically racist. The vast majority of people in America favor intermarriage, for example. And our most important institutions, like the churches, the military, are well integrated. So something else is going on with this supply of young people who are flooding into the streets, screaming about how they are victims and antagonizing the people around them. And I think the answer, Teresa, is fatherlessness, by which I mean partly literal fatherlessness. A lot of kids grow up in the United States and have for a couple of generations now without a paternal figure in the home. But it's beyond literal fatherlessness. A lot of these same young people, the millennials, the Zoomers, are disconnected from church, disconnected from organized religion, and disconnected from their country. So we're talking about people who have no North Star to guide them and no way of constructing their identities, you know, in the usual way with reference to family, country, church, etc. I think what we are seeing is a new kind of social dysfunction where people are desperate to join something, anything that will give them a sense of belonging and identity. And this problem has been building since the sexual revolution began, but now we are seeing it in the streets, and that's something new.
And what about, in addition to what you just mentioned, Mary, you combine that with these young people going through schools where there's so much indoctrination?
Well, of course, what's happened in the public schools especially is also part of this picture because increasingly an anti-American, you know, 1619 project style manner of indoctrination is what kids get. In other words, they're taught to disrespect their country and their origins, and that is just not something that any healthy society does. So that's very much part of the picture. But I think the rage that we saw that you mentioned, Teresa, that the fury on the faces of these young people is really something new. Mm-hmm. And it's why I come back to the idea of a new kind of social dysfunction on the part of people who don't know where they come from, who know only that they have been dispossessed somehow. They sense that something is wrong. They just don't have the right words to describe it. So they rage about the patriarchy or heteronormativity or all of these abstractions, whereas what's really ailing them is something a lot closer to home, literally.
Yeah, and you mentioned the sexual revolution as well, and I think also abortion has a lot to do with this. There's a lot of rage out there, both in men and women, that is not addressed in terms of if you look at the numbers of abortion and many women having more than one abortion, and then they don't have a chance to really understand what has happened to them, and there's this rage building because of this hurt and this pain and maybe feeling isolated or pressured. So that, I'm sure, folds into it as well.
Yes, there's just a general feeling of disconnection. And, of course, abortion has also, in an unseen way, it has subtracted people out of the lives of other people. You know, one thing I talk about in the piece is that there's this loneliness out there. We have to understand it's not just that there's family disruption and fatherless homes. It's also that a lot of kids are growing up without siblings, without a sibling of the opposite sex. There's just a general collapse of social learning out there. And it's part of what is, I think, at the subterranean roots of what ails us as a country, as a society, is that we are facing larger and larger numbers of young people who really don't have a clue about who they are and what they're supposed to do in life.
And then you add all the isolation and the pandemic, and I just was telling my listeners off the top of the hour before we brought you on about a new survey that came out, some new studies from three different universities looking at young adults about how they are just really struggling with depression. It's way up, and the levels are comparable to what they were back in May when we first saw some really high numbers after the lockdowns. More with Mary Eberstadt. She's a senior fellow at the Faith and Reason Institute. She's an author and a speaker and a beautiful essay, very powerful, and I mean beautiful in a way that really dives into things that we need to hear about. The Fury of the Fatherless, helping us understand what's going on out there in the culture and why this rage is occurring. It's at firstthings.com. We'll be right back.
Hi, everybody. Dr. Ray Guarendi here. Well, because of COVID constrictions, we've been forced to get creative. We are going to tape some episodes of Living Right with Dr. Ray, the TV show on EWTN, on November 30th. But they're going to be virtual, which means you can be part of the audience. We're going to have three monitors up in the studio. I'll be in the studio. I can talk to you, and you can talk to me. You can talk to the guests. They can talk to you. This will be great. Now, we're going to do it on November 30th. The times that you have as options are 1:30, 4, and 6:30, November 30th. You go to drray.com/virtual today, because the numbers are going up fast. We'd love to have you. We got a limit of 60. Dr. Ray, DRRAY.com/virtual to reserve your spot. We'll send you the information. Hope to see you.
The Catholic Church teaches that Jesus Christ is literally and wholly present, body and blood, soul and divinity, under the appearances of bread and wine. St. John the Apostle records the John chapter 6 Bread of Life discourse, in which Jesus states that his flesh is true food and his blood true drink. Who better to understand John's writings and subsequent teachings than a disciple and student of John, St. Ignatius of Antioch? In his letter to the Smyrnians in 110 AD, Ignatius writes, "I have no taste for corruptible food, nor for the pleasures of this life. I desire the bread of God, which is the flesh of Jesus Christ. And for drink, I desire his blood, which is love incorruptible." The Catholic Church absolutely follows St. John and St. Ignatius in taking Jesus at his word. Examining the truths of the Catholic faith, this is faithforensics.org.
You're listening to the best of Catholic Connection with Teresa Tamia.
Welcome back, Catholic Connection. Having a very important conversation with our dear sister, Mary Eberstadt. She's a senior fellow at the Faith and Reason Institute. She's an author. She's a speaker. And this essay on First Things is so important. Check it out. It's at firstthings.com. The title is The Fury of the Fatherless. And I want to bring out just, I mean, we've been talking about this during the break, but you quote someone I'm a big fan of as well as your work, but Catholic theologian Deborah Savage, who's incredible. She talks about the sinkhole. You mentioned this. The sinkhole into which all three have collapsed is now a public hazard. You're talking about father, you know, without a father, father and the piety toward the country. The threefold crisis of paternity is depriving many young people, especially young men, of reasons to live as rational and productive citizens. As a Catholic theologian, Deborah Savage put it recently, reflecting on America's youth, and this is a very, very powerful quote, "They have been left alone in a cosmos with nothing to guide them, not even a firm grasp of what constitutes their basic humanity, and no means of finding their way home." Wow. Your thoughts
on
that?
Well, I think that's exactly what we're seeing out there, Teresa. I mean, you have to ask yourself, If you watched the news all summer and you saw these young people, say, in Portland, Oregon, demonstrating in the streets night after night, looking excited to be there as dusk was falling and staying up all night, throwing bottles and worse at the police, et cetera, where are they coming from?
Right.
These young men, and they are mostly young men, are not going back to families of their own. They're not married with children in the house. They are completely disconnected from the civilized order. And that, I think, is the problem that we all have to wrestle with. It's not only that they're disconnected, it's also that there is this animus against people who have what they don't. And the reason I say that is that if you look at what the demonstrators did this summer, some of it was just political theater of a kind we haven't seen before. They were walking through residential neighborhoods, shouting in the middle of the night, shining flashlights into people's bedrooms to wake them up. Mm-hmm. Think about the symbolism there, to wake up people in the safety of their homes. These demonstrators were also in city after city going around at a time when people could only go to restaurants outdoors,
right,
and disrupting families eating dinner together.
Mm-hmm.
What does that tell you? It tells you that they know what they're missing. It tells you that there's some kind of familial dysfunction at the root of this social unrest. And the same is true for the statues. It started with pulling down Confederate statues. Okay, that's something we could have a discussion about. But it didn't end there. It went on to the pulling down of town fathers' statues or city fathers or Mahatma Gandhi or Father Sarah or anything that looked like a paternal authority figure. Again, what happened reveals the familial root of this social problem. And it's profound.
So what do we, as people of faith, especially in the church, do about this? How do we respond?
Well, first we have to call things by their right names, which is not what is happening in the mainstream media.
Oh, I'm shocked. Pardon my sarcasm. I said I'm shocked that the mainstream media aren't calling it as it is. That's my area of expertise. But go ahead.
Right. But as with any diagnosis, we have to get the diagnosis right in order to cure the patient. So first of all, we have to understand that this is a hunger for paternal authority that we're seeing in a twisted way on the streets of the United States. But also, Teresa, I think it's a great moment for creativity on the part of both the clergy and the laity, because the church has an answer to this. The church has an answer to the search for paternity, and it is to find the Father, capital F, in the church. So for all that the church has problems right now, I think it's a great moment to use the spiritual assets we have on the understanding that what people are looking for is benevolent paternal authority out there, mm-hmm. and reach out.
How do we get beyond, though, and I think this is a question on the minds of many people, especially we just had the McCarrick report come out, and the people who serve as our spiritual fathers, whether they be bishops, cardinals, or priests, are obviously it's a very small number who committed abuse, but the general sense out there is that it's the leadership is very poor, and we have so much to do in our own house in terms of fatherhood, or lack thereof.
The church will always have a lot to do in our own house, but we can't lose sight of the fact that the church also has things to offer, especially to these disconnected young people, that no one else can put out there. And we have to have faith in that. You know, I draw hope from the fact that these people in the streets who are raging about being victims are actually onto something authentic. They are victims. They've been dispossessed of their heritage, of their parenthood in many cases. They are victims. They just need to learn the language that tells them what kind of victims they are. And I think we can help with that. And the first way to do it is to shine a bright light on what's going on out there.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of the response to the article, what have you been hearing in the essay?
It seems to have touched a nerve. It seems to be getting around. I'm not big on social media, but I'm told that it's making the rounds quickly. And what that suggests to me is that there's something in it that people recognize. They recognize that there is more going on out there than even COVID and lockdowns. There's something fundamental changing in America, and especially among the young. So I think that sense is part of why there's such an interest in the essay.
Yeah, it's very powerful. We're talking with Mary Eberstadt, Senior Fellow at the Faith and Reason Institute, author and speaker. Her essay, The Fury of the Fatherless, is what we're discussing this morning. It's posted at firstthings.com. So after the Bishop's Conference, is there an opportunity for maybe you and Deborah Savage, because you're both so well-educated and know the faith so well and speak out there in the culture so much, to maybe sit down with some of the bishops and express this and kind of help them understand what you've been looking at? Is there an openness to it at this point from the leadership, or hasn't it been just come up yet at this point?
Oh, I think the openness is there, and I think the bishops know better than we do, because they see this in their pastoral practice all the time. They just need to know that there are people in the laity who want to help them go forward and connect with especially young people and stop, you know, being apologetic about the church all the time. The church has things to apologize for, but it's time to take the kick me sign off and address some of the suffering.
That's a great analogy. I'm just thinking about that. That's so true, you know, because I understand that, because we do have so much to offer, especially so much great witness in terms of our saints and the history of the church. So what can we do, Mary, as lady? You mentioned that. Let's take the kick me sign off, but individually, what does that look like for the lady, do you think?
Well, I think it means, first of all, to support the counterculture out there. I mean, one great development that's not talked about nearly enough of the last 20 years is that we have these institutions now. We have, for example, FOCUS, the Fellowship of Catholic University
yes.
Students, on over 100 campuses, and Thomistic Circles on every Ivy League campus and a lot of other ones by now. We have these Catholic institutions that didn't exist before that are specifically addressed to the young. And not only on campus. We have the Love and Fidelity Network is another example. So people need to know that these options are out there to be supported with moral support and other kinds of support, because I think those grassroots organizations are the way to reach the young.
Thank you so much for your insight and for this powerful piece, The Fury of the Fatherless, found at firstthings.com. Our guest, author, speaker, and... of course, she is the senior fellow at the Faith and Reason Institute, Mary Eberstadt. We'll be right back.
Bishop Robert Barron on the priesthood.
I've been a priest for 31 years. It's a call to a total gift to Christ. It's a total gift of one's life to be conformed to Christ. You know, and that's why I felt it when I was a young guy and I was kind of getting into religion and understanding it more deeply intellectually. It just began to hit me with a great clarity that if this is true, if God is real and God is a supreme good, well, why wouldn't I give my whole self to God? Why would I get distracted by anything else, you know? Now, again, I'm not saying that should be true for every single person on the planet. That's the way it hit me when I was a young guy, was I want to give as much as I can, my whole self, to Christ. So there's something heroic about that, where you do eschew a lot of things. You say no to a lot of things so you can say massively yes to Christ and to his demand. I think that's a heroic quality of it.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
The EWTN home video highlight for November is A Wolf in Sheep's Clothing 2, The Gender Agenda.
For two centuries, the ideologues of socialism or communism have used deceptive word jugglery to rebrand themselves as liberals or progressives.
Order your DVD at EWTNRC.com, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, or call 1-800-854-6316.
Call to Communion.
Through EWTN Radio, we talk to audiences all over the world. One thing I've found out is everybody in the whole world has the same set of questions. They live the same human life. They all want meaning. They all want love. They all want significance. They want forgiveness. That's the most fascinating thing to me. The same answers work wherever you are throughout the world, because we're all children of God.
Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders, this afternoon, 2 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Connection with Teresa Tamia.
Welcome back, Catholic Connection. An honor and a blessing. blessing to speak with Dr. Thomas Hilgers. His book is The Fake and Deceptive Science Behind Roe v. Wade. And Dr. Hilgers, first of all, just thank you for the amazing work that you do. You have been the director of the St. Paul VI Institute. You're the founder, and you've done so much to help not only women with infertility issues, but helping women understand the beautiful design and how to correct some of the issues they may be having, very different from what the medical community in the secular world has told them. Let's throw the birth control pill at it and whatever you want to do is fine. So you've done so much. Yeah. But I want to concentrate this morning on why you decided, first of all, to write about the issue of Roe v. Wade and the fake and deceptive science. Great title of the book, by the way, behind the Supreme Court decision.
Well, it's actually my fourth book on abortion, and but I haven't written a book in almost 40 years, actually. And the original books were kind of the same style books, looking at the history, looking at this, looking at that.
Mm-hmm.
This particular book has been ruminating in my mind for a long time, and it's taken me a long time to do the research on it, actually. But it's when I read Roe v. Wade originally, it was clear that there were things in Roe that were not true, not correct, and certainly not correct with our current understanding of the science. It had to do with three main issues. One is, how many illegal abortions were there? You constantly hear that 5,000 or 10,000 women were dying every year from coat hanger abortions. That was not true. The second was that the maternal mortality rate associated with abortion and childbirth was 23 times higher in ordinary and normal childbirth than it was in abortion. And then the last one was that life did not really begin at conception. It began like millions of years ago. I mean, that was the implication in Roe. And on all three of them, they're wrong, and so I just took me a long time to do the research on it, because it's crafty how they use words. For example, they used words such as the maternal mortality rate in normal childbirth is 23.3 times higher than it is in abortion, for example. So obviously, you should choose abortion, because after all, that's a lot safer for women. The problem with that is, and I didn't notice it for a very long time, is that the word normal or ordinary, those are the two words they used throughout the decision, is not associated with maternal death at all. So the maternal mortality rate is zero. But this all came from the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, which is probably one of the biggest pro-abortion lobbies in the country, most dangerous. Although they like to come across, of course, as being the doctors of women's health and so forth. Anyway, it turns out that these were wrong statements, and they weren't. You can't just you could say that the court could make that decision, because they're lay people and all, but this was given to them by the American College, and they know better that normal childbirth is not a problem, never has been a problem. Even back centuries ago, when they didn't have a lot of medicine. If a woman does die in childbirth, it's due to some catastrophic complication, and it's not related to normal at all. And so we got that resolved, and then on the other issues, we were able to move forward. The question of when does life begin has been known. It was known before Roe v. Wade that life began at conception. Justice Blackmun, who wrote that decision, made a comment in Roe v. Wade that said basically that we need not resolve the issue of when life begins. That we'll have to leave for another time. Mm. Well, of course, you don't hear much talk about it because they haven't really revisited it. But they need to revisit it, because what they published then and what their rationale was wrong. It was deceptive at the very least, and a flat-out lie to say that it is somehow a process over time that began millions of years ago. And But anyway, that's what they said, and so I went ahead and put together all this just to try to defeat those three main scientific issues that they promoted and move on.
Well, what's so important, I was just telling my listeners at the top of the hour that these lies that first came out very early on, even before Roe v. Wade and Doe v. Bolton, we still have them today, Doctor. You know that.
We do. No, we do. Absolutely. Chelsea Clinton, not too long ago, a couple of years ago, was cited on television or in a newspaper article, I forget which, but anyway, that if we make abortion illegal, there are going to be 10,000 women dying every year of cocaine or abortions. It's the same argument that was there in 1967, 77, 87, you know, the whole gamut, and they don't revisit it because it worked well for them at the time, and not because it was true, but just it was an emotionally attaching argument. And
Right. And so many people hang on to that. We're having a dynamic conversation with Dr. Thomas Hilgers. His book is The Fake and Deceptive Science Behind Roe v. Wade, Settled Law versus Settled Science. And he is a founder and director of the beautiful St. Paul VI Institute, PopePaulVI.com. And that's Pope Paul and then the Roman numeral 6.com, a place of hope and healing. This is a one step that we need to do. A book like this is so powerful and helpful. What else can we do in addition to letting people know about your work and passing this book out as we go into the break to dispel some of these myths and these blatant lies that have been sold, this bill of goods that has been sold to all of us, especially women, since Roe v. Wade?
Well, we've developed this new women's health science called NAPRO technology, natural procreative technology, which combines education for women and their husbands and spouses and boyfriends or whoever it is, and also combine it with current practice of medicine with regard to women's health, which is basically birth control pills.
Just got it yesterday. I know literally it's hot off the presses, but I open up to Chapter 7, A Picture Dictionary of Human Life in the Womb. You start with 1973, and then you go on to show ultrasounds and what we see now in the womb, which is just unbelievable in terms of being fearfully and wonderfully made, as it says in our scriptures. We were talking about getting the word out. This is a great book, I think, to pass. I would say it's not so technical, but for the average person can understand it and read it, correct?
Yes, I think so, and we've gotten some reviews on it that also suggest that for people who are just lay people. I don't mean just, but you know, they get a fright of a medically oriented text. It's not a very big book, as you know, and it's easy reading. A couple hours and it's done, and it's filled with a lot of really important information for us to understand the abortion issue, and this is the number one human rights issue in my mind that currently exists, the freedom of the unborn. You know, it's like free the unborn. It's just ridiculous. It's a violent, ugly, horrendous action to abort a baby. A live baby, and we all want to look the other way. I don't mean we, you, and I, but
right.
So many people in our culture just want to look the other way.
In our church, want to look the other way.
Oh yes, exactly. In this videotape, I talk about identity politics a little bit, because if there's a certain group in the population that focuses everything on whether you're a black person or a white person or a yellow person or whatever kind of person, whatever you look like. The problem is that the unborn has always been hidden all these centuries.
Right.
You know, for all the time of pregnancy, and they don't really know what it looks like. But now it's different. We can see these babies. A four-dimensional ultrasound on the videotape that's on the internet at noknowreality.us. There's babies moving in the womb that we can capture by three- and four-dimensional ultrasound now. And, I mean, there's no question what these babies are. And so we have to come up to grips. So the question I was trying to answer in this book is, you know, a lot of times, in fact, with the Supreme Court hearings just starting, they'll probably be asking whether or not Roe v. Wade is settled law. Well, they asked that at the last hearing, and they would normally say, well, it's settled law. But how can it be settled law if the science is not settled? It was right. It was so skewed and so falsified that it's even worse than not being settled. It was you know, we were used as kind of idiots thinking that this just wasn't real, you know.
Well, not only that, but women were used and are still being used. And you were talking before the break about the birth control pill. That's the answer for everything. And, you know, ignoring all the problems that it causes, and not to mention it's an abortifacient and everything else that comes along with it. Oh, you've got some issue, take the pill. Oh, you've got this, take the pill.
Yeah, exactly. That's
and,
exactly
and yet
correct.
You've got women coming to you that aren't even coming to you from a Catholic. Many are, because they want to be true to their faith and they want help with being able to solve infertility or figure out what's going on if they have other issues. But many people come to you because they want something that is natural and works with their body, not against it.
Well, they're not against the idea of doing it in a way which is consistent with moral principles.
Right.
And I remember back when we first started looking at developing the Institute, we would talk to one of the local Catholic hospitals here, and one of the people asked me, isn't Pope Paul the Sixth Institute an awfully Catholic sounding name? And I couldn't believe it. I mean I was shocked. I don't know what else to say. I mean they were Catholic hospitals themselves, and why would they say something like that? It's taken me 30 or 40 years since then to realize that because it was called the Pope Paul the Sixth Institute, we've seen patients from all over the world. Every state in the United States and six continents have been to the Pope Paul VI Institute to find the causes of what their problems have been, and in many cases, the solution to them.
Yeah.
And eventually we'll have cures for some of these things that are pretty relentless, but it's been a pretty amazing work, and it's all because it is a moral program, so...
I was just talking the other day about Paul the Sixth and Humana Vitae, and looking back, and I keep repeating this, but it's worth repeating. And if you read that encyclical, which is, by the way, very short and very easy to read, I mean, you talk about prophetic. I don't think even he realized at the time how prophetic to the nth degree it would be, especially in terms of women. Well, I love the timing of this book. We were talking about that during the break, and you didn't realize, and who knew? I mean, you know, God knew, but we didn't know that this was going to come out the same time, the week of hearings. It's like God's like, okay, I'm God, and this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to put this out there at the same time. That's what he does, because he's orchestrating everything.
He does. It's amazing how things coincide like that.
Yeah. Well, God bless you, Doctor, and all your great work. And I know you're so busy, and we're so excited when my producer, Andrew, told me we were able to get you on for two segments. And I've got the book in front of me, The Fake and Deceptive Science Behind Roe v. Wade, Settled Law versus Settled Science. What a book to get right now and to share with other people about the lies that they've swallowed from the secular media, from the culture, from politicians who are bought and sold by the abortion industry, and even many people in the church who call themselves Catholics and agree with this. Lies, 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 and more lies. Get the book. It's terrific. The Fake and Deceptive Science Behind Roe v. Wade. Settled Law versus Settled Science. We'll put a link on the archive section. More information, go to PopePaulVI.com. Again, PopePaulVI.com. We'll also have a link to the interview there that we did today as well. We'll be right back.
Religious freedom and healthcare and the right to life are under the greatest attack in American history. Right now, Catholic healthcare and the pro-life movement hang in the balance. My name is Lewis Brown, Executive Director of the Christ Medicus Foundation, and we are leading a new movement to defend religious freedom and civil rights in healthcare and to build the culture of life. We need your help now more than ever. Join this movement. Go to religiousfreedomandhealthcare.org. That's religiousfreedomandhealthcare.org.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically own shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Hi, I'm Al Cresta. Over the last 50 years, we've had some of the greatest popes since the Reformation era.
So why are things such a mess in American Catholicism? How do we analyze and confront the attacks we're facing? How do we identify wolves in sheep's clothing? How do we re-evangelize the baptized? Dr. Ralph Martin makes sense of a church in crisis and shows pathways forward. He'll make sense of a disordered world. Go to AveMariaRadio.net and you'll find it in our online bookstore.
Join Monica Miller, Janet Smith, Joe Scheidler, and other great speakers for the Red Rose Rescue National Pro-Life Conference. Learn about and become part of this exciting, bold, and effective defense of the unborn. Be there Saturday, December 12th in St. Charles, Missouri. Attend virtually or in person. For all details and to register, see RedRoseRescue.com, RedRoseRescue.com.
If you have any questions about a program you heard today or maybe yesterday, or if you have a question about something we do here at Catholic Radio, just give us a little note at EWTN.com or AveMariaRadio.net. You can also find out some background information about the various programs. You can get updates on our radio and TV schedules. It's all there for you online. And remember, we are here to keep you connected to your Catholic faith. And as my dear, dear friend and Catholic Radio colleague Al Cresta always says, to help you remember to look at everything in our lives through the lenses of Scripture and the teachings of the Church. And remember what I always say, something I heard years ago, that our Catholic faith has to be everything to us. It has to come first. I'll never forget that. I heard a priest give a homily, and this was during one of the most contentious elections recently, and he said, our Catholic faith shouldn't be a factor when we go into the voting booth. It should be the factor. Because, again, we have to look at everything through the lenses of Scripture and the teachings of our one holy Catholic and apostolic faith. Hope you enjoyed the program today, and we'll talk to you tomorrow on Catholic Connection.
You've been listening to Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo. Catholic Connection is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio, and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Our producer is Andrew Krucek. For copies of this program or for more information, visit AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMariaRadio.net. Thanks for listening, and join us next time for another edition of Catholic Connection.